This is a good experience for us. Carla and I pride ourselves on always starting on time and having everything together and not imposing upon you any confusion or craziness of putting together one of these things. And of course, all of that's fine and dandy, but the truth is we don't have anything to say about it. We are always graced and lucky when things go well. And I'm grateful for the patient, your patience. I come here, as I go everywhere, to speak about self-inquiry. Does anybody have no idea what self-inquiry is or what I have to say about it? Good. So I'm going to start with a little story. I am kind of notorious for having no truck with metaphysical and spiritual discussions and ideas and things like that. I think they're okay, you know, I think they're enjoyable, they're for entertainment. But I don't have much time for them. I've lost interest in them over the years. And Bob, you've heard this story, but nobody else has, so I just learned recently where this, from whence came this impulse on the part of us who are taken by the spiritual possibility to talk about reality as if we could say anything real about reality. Started a long time ago. Long time ago. You know, like 1,000 years before Christ, even longer than that, the Aryans, who were a tribe of people, a gathering of people who lived on the steppes northwest of India, they had lived there in peace for a long, long time. There were mostly shepherds and herders and gatherers of agricultural stuff, and they pretty much stayed in place. They didn't bother anybody. And then one group of them discovered that up north of them in Armenia, there were other people who had succeeded in domesticating the horse. And in domesticating the horse, they had also come upon the possibility of making war chariots and waging war on their neighbors and being able to dispense with the need to plant seeds and tend to crops and keep cows and so forth, because they stole all that from their neighbors. So one part of this Aryan bunch, they got a hold of Armenian horses and Armenian war chariots and so forth, and they proceeded to turn on the rest of the Aryans and take all their cows and their sheep and their agriculture and the food that they had stored and take it for themselves, and in the process slaughter anybody who got in their way and just generally have a good time. Cowboys. One thing led to another, and those of the Aryans who were retained their peaceful agricultural and herding ways, they had a religious insight, which became Zoroastrianism. And of course, no religious insight can hold against the power of galloping war chariots and so forth. So in the end, the Zoroastrians were driven out of that area and they ended up in Iran, Persia. And the cowboys, they're the ones who drifted into India and began to migrate through southeast through India toward the Ganges basin and so forth, burning and murdering, raping and pillaging as they went along. It was they who were the original source of the Vedas and much of the religious ideas about equality between self and fire and the true self, and all of those things. Most of those ideas and most of the Vedic prescriptions about the living of life comes from the descendants of these cowboys, the people on the horses and chariots. And eventually, you know, they kind of got populous and settled into the area, and met some of them began to concentrate more on spiritual matters than on matters of how to feed themselves and take stuff from their neighbors and things like that. And more of the Vedas were written, and at one point, about 1,000 years before Christ, the idea occurred to them of Brahman. Brahman, the one, the one without a second, the all in all, Brahman. And of course, they saw pretty quickly that there was nothing that they could say about Brahman, because they were within Brahman, and there was no way, therefore, that they could conceptualize and understand Brahman as an object within them. So it became clear to them pretty quickly that there was nothing much they could say about this reality. So what they did about that was they started playing a game for their entertainment's sake. And they would gather together, and one of them would ask another of them a question about the nature of Brahman, about the nature of reality. And the one who was asked would answer as best he or she could, and then would get to ask a question of their own, of their opponent. And the opponent would answer as best as they could, and so forth, and this would go back and forth until finally one of them simply could not find anything to say and was kind of struck dumb. And all assembled were stunned into a vast silence at the recognition of the inadequacy of human reason to say anything real. And that vast silence that they were stunned into was the deliciousness that they sought in playing the game in the first place. They knew already that there was nothing whatsoever they could say that was real. They just sought that experience of vastness and silence that came at the end of the game. And of course, the silence and vastness and the experience of it did not remain, and so therefore it took doing this again and again. And pretty much within much of the spiritual realm, it's the same thing we're doing now. Same thing we're always doing. Now, so that's the reason, I think, why I have so little interest in talking about reality, because it's really obvious to me that there's nothing that can be said about reality anyway, and I have lost the taste for these passing experiences of vastness and silence, since reality is here always. Reality is what you are always. And there's no need to seek some special aspect of that for entertainment. I have other things I can do for entertainment. Still, I talk. But I don't so much talk about reality because I don't have anything to say about reality. I talk about you and the possibility of being finished with the idea that you are at stake in this life. You know, it means nothing to me. People go and try to get spiritual experiences or material experiences or intellectual experiences or any of that. that's what we do, you know? I mean, others of us go to the movies or watch TV. But I don't see much difference between going to the movies and watching TV and engaging in spiritual speculation, seeking that hit, that rush of recognition. I had a meeting on the phone with a woman yesterday who lives in Canada, and she has been listening to our podcast and watching the videos and reading the stuff that's on the web and so forth, and has really been quite affected by what she's heard and what she's seen there. And she wanted to talk to me about some things that confused her, and so we set up a meeting on the phone. I talked to her yesterday afternoon, and one of the things that she asked me, you know, I've said often, I think, in satsang, that in self-inquiry, and by the way, so just so that we're all on the same page here, when I speak about self-inquiry, what I'm speaking about is the conscious, intentional effort to see yourself face to face without mediation or understanding or the need for that moment to last even. Just the conscious, intentional effort whenever you can to see yourself face to face, knowing it to be you. And one of the things she asked me about was that, what I meant when I said that the inquiry has to be conscious. Because, you see, the game of the Aryan spiritual aspirants, the game of the spiritual aspirants brought them face to face with reality. It did. But there was no recognition that what they were seeing was them. What they were seeing was Brahman, vastness, infinite, consciousness, love, whatever. Not you, not me, but something else, something other, something that I might aspire to be or aspire to be true to, or aspire to understand, or aspire to get more of, but not me. So she asked me what I meant by this business of conscious self-inquiry and the prerequisite that it be conscious. And it's just that. It's just that. Anywhere we go in the spiritual universe, any satsangs we attend, any meditation sessions we attend, any yoga sessions we attend, anything we do whatsoever has a great likelihood of bringing us momentarily in touch with the reality of what we are without us knowing that it's the reality of what we are. Self-inquiry brings us directly face to face with the reality of what I am in the full conscious knowledge that this is what I am. And that's the knife that cuts through. So that's what I mean when I talk about it being conscious. It isn't any special spiritual ooga booga thing. It's just that when we do this practice, when we do this inquiry into the reality of my nature, because you see, it's really true that the only problem in our lives anywhere to be found is a false belief that we are our lives. That's really true. And I know it's true from my own experience, and I know it's true from the reports of people who have undertaken this inquiry themselves. The reports that come to me all the time from people who say, you know what? I really don't understand what I'm doing, but everything's just fine. Really, everything's just fine. So, if it's true that, as I claim, that the only problem is a false belief about what I am, and that false belief is that I am my life, then the only possible solution to it can have nothing to do with anything I do in my life. The solution can't be encouraged or kept from by anything I do in my life. All of that's beside the point of the main problem, which is this false belief. And if it's true that that's the only problem, then the only solution has to be. It's just so obvious that a child could see it. It has to be the truth. If it's true that it's a false belief that causes me my misery and my heartache and my longing and my underlying seeking, then the only solution has to be the truth. Has to be. And the only way to see the truth is to look at it, look for it consciously. So self-inquiry, the self-inquiry I speak of, is precisely this conscious, intentional effort to look at myself, to see myself face to face as often as possible, whenever it occurs to me to do so. And the promise is that if you do that, over time, the sense that you are at stake in your life will vanish. Over time. The sense that you are at stake in what's thought or done or what happens to you or what you do to somebody else vanishes over time. And what's revealed is that, as always, life is, well, self-realization. Your life is self-realization. It's not, realization is not something that happens to you. It is you. It is you as your life in this world, in this moment. And that cannot be learned. That cannot be you cannot be persuaded of that. You cannot be made to believe that instead of whatever else you believe. That is the natural, inevitable outcome of consistently, consciously making the effort to look at you, to look yourself in the face, to see what you are. And what you are is here. This is the good news. This effort to see yourself is not hard. It's not like reserved for the few special, advanced, many births, avatars, and so forth. It's easy. And it's easy because you're here. You're always here. You're never absent. You're absolutely certain that you're never absent. There's no possibility of persuading you that you are sometimes here and sometimes not here. And you're always aware of that. So the inquiry is, much easier done than said. I guarantee you, if you look to see what it is that you are, you will see yourself. I guarantee that. If you look to see what is not changed, what is permanent, you will also see yourself, but you won't know it to be yourself. You must look for you. And when you see the reality of the never absent, certain presence of you, you will see it to be just that, permanent, unchanging, untouched, never affected, unhelped or unhurt by anything whatsoever. And then you'll look somewhere else. You'll look to something else. You'll look to entertainment or samadhis or get drunk or get high or... And then it'll occur to you again, just for a second, just to stop. What am I really? What is it to be really? And it's that persistence over time that pays off. It's that persistence over time, that determination, whenever you think of it, to just stop for a second. You don't have to go into a corner. You can if you want to. You're there too. But you don't have to. Just for a second, stop and look at yourself. And before you know it, that belief that you are your life, and with it the idea that you are at stake in your life, and with it the natural, automatic separation of you from your life, the holding at bay, your thoughts, your desires, what you want, what you don't want, all of that, before you know it, will be gone. And maybe you will retain interest in the entertainment of spiritual discourse, and maybe you won't. But if you seek entertainment, you'll be seeking entertainment and not peace, fulfillment, enlightenment, realization, or anything of the like. I don't have any interest in spiritual discussions, but I've discovered that I do have an interest in the history of spiritual development, because it's interesting to see from whence comes these occupations that enthrall us so. I guess I don't have anything else to say. Michelle? Hi, it's good to see you.
It's good to see you. I have a question.
Okay.
When you said that once you recognize who you are, then you're finished.
I didn't say that.
Okay, I perceived it as once you recognize what you see, then you're finished with the story and the drama and stuff. Life still goes on, but the madness is gone. That's what I perceived.
When the belief that you are your life is gone, mm-hmm. the madness goes with it.
Right.
Right now, in this moment, you know very well that you can look and see the reality of what you are.
Mm-hmm.
You're here.
Mm-hmm.
You're not changed. Nothing hurts you. Nothing helps you. You can see that. Seeing that just like that is, and thinking that that will bring an end to the madness in my life is a kind of childish thing that we hold on to. I had somebody write to me not long ago asking me if there is not some massive shift that occurs. How could that be? If what we're speaking about is you, and if you are ever present and permanently present, then how could being finished with a false belief about what you are represent a massive shift in anything? It's not, you see, the thing that we are looking at here is not seeking after some new thing to come to us. It's not seeking after the realization and enlightenment to come to us. It is a practice, the purpose of which is to rid us of a disease, of a false belief. Nothing can give you what you are. Nothing. Nothing can, there's no experience that will be authentic and, oh, now I get it, now I see what I am. You are always the same. You never move, you never change. The purpose of the practice, therefore, is not to bring you realization or to bring you enlightenment or to bring you peace or love or anything at all, but to get rid of this false belief. Not to get rid of the thing that I falsely believe myself to be, even. Just to get rid of the belief. Just to do away with that. You know, we have in our lifetimes, in our spiritual adventure, we see that, we've heard that, and we've turned it into an idea that what we have to do is get rid of ego, because it's ego that I am falsely identified with. But nobody's had any luck at that, so that can't be it. This false belief is the lens through which you see everything. It's not something that you can trade off and say, okay, I'm going to believe something different. It's the lens through which you see everything. And the eradication of that belief is to just get rid of that lens. And that's what inquiry is intended to do. And it's intended to do that by the repeated meeting with the reality of what you are, because the lie can't stand up over time, over repeated contact with reality. No lie can. But it takes time. It takes time for that falseness to depart, to be eaten up, to be eroded away. For me, it took a long time, a lot of work.
When you say long time, how long?
Hundred years? That's too long.
No, I think I've been doing that too, 100 years.
In this lifetime, it took, once the desperate need, like there was a time when there was the appearance of a real desperate need to be finished with this nonsense. Whatever the nonsense was, there was a real desperate need in me. I could not live unless I could be finished with this. And if that meant, and you see, that's the other thing about looking for love or looking for peace or looking for emptiness or looking for awareness or looking for Brahman or looking for true self. That's the other thing about it. The desperate need brought me to the realization that what I needed absolutely to see was the reality of what I am, and not to see myself as love, and not to see myself as Brahman, and not to see myself as anything except reality of what I am. And once that desperate need got a hold of me, it took couple of years, really, before I don't know how to speak of it except a false belief, a lie, went away. But that's the thing. You have to see that what you're looking for is the reality of what you are and not something that will confirm some idea you have about what you should be, like love or peace or emptiness or awareness, but to see what you are really. And how hard can that be? Because you're here. You're here. And it's hard to hold your attention on this reality, but it isn't hard at all to catch a flash of it. You're here. What am I? What am I? And the reality of what you are never moves. Your attention will skitter away into, I don't know, movies and spiritual discourse and politics and some and other things, all of which are fine, and no problem with them. But it's those moments of the direct conscious seeing of that which nothing can be said about, knowing it to be you. It's those moments, the accumulation of those moments that destroys this false belief. And for some it may be quick, easy, like that. For others it may be like me, you know, like, oh God. But here's the thing, and that is that whether it takes long time or short time to rid yourself of that belief, nothing has happened to you. Nothing. You are the same. Okay?
When I first came here, I remember telling you in the 5-day meeting that I wanted justice.
Justice.
And you told me, who wants justice?
Uh-huh.
And when I quit seeking that, I saw it was everywhere.
Yes, that's true, boy. Justice is I was going to say something. Justice ain't what you think it is. Justice is what made us start at 8 o'clock tonight instead of at 7:30.
Thank you.
You're very welcome, Michelle. You keep looking, okay? And I have to say something else, and I've been saying this more and more lately as I see more clearly the truth of it, and that is that I'm getting better at this than I used to be. I really am. A lot of the extraneous stuff that I used to have a kind of unconscious need to honor has fallen away. And I really don't have any interest in anything except you. And I don't have any interest in anything except being able to say as clearly as possible what it is that I see in my own experience, as clearly as possible what I know will finish the madness. Really.
Meeting you stopped me from searching. It stopped my search. And it helped me tremendously.
Oh, I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah. And I'm happy, you know. I'm crying now, but I'm very happy with that
life. Yeah.
These are happy tears.
Okay. Anybody else? Sue?
I have two questions.
Okay, I'm glad to see you.
Glad to see you.
Okay.
First one, the second one's simple, so I'll start with the first. I'll start with the messy one.
Okay.
Let's do politics.
It's politics?
Politics, yeah. For a while recently, I was feeling quite schizophrenic because I was still somewhat, well, unable to divest myself of an interest in spiritual matters. Let me say, I would like to be rid of it entirely, but it seems to keep coming back. And also being a activist and involving myself in all of the many atrocities that go on around us. And I heard on the radio a gentleman, his name's Andrew Harvey, and he talked about sacred activism. And suddenly something went click. And what I think now, and this is what I want to bounce off you, because I know you've been there. It seems to me...
Activistry.
Yeah.
I've been there.
Yeah, I've been there. It seems to me that the more one could deeply understand one's own nature, the more it would free one to... See, obviously, I'm going theoretical here. But if I deeply understood this, as I do in little flashes, it seems to me I wouldn't get so torqued.
You would what?
I get torqued. Like last night listened to some...
And you wouldn't get so torqued, right?
Yeah. I was listening to these young Iraq veterans against the war. And the pain is so excruciating that you think, well, I can't continue with this. But if you understood that what was feeling the pain was not the real nature, then it would be easier to continue. So that's the question, if you can see the question there.
Let me try to approach this, okay? In the first place, the idea that there's a need to divest yourself of spiritual interests is false. The idea that there's any need to divest yourself of political activism, if there is such an idea, is equally false. There's no need to do anything at all about what unfolds in your life, really. And in fact, it's my experience, my long and bitter experience, that all efforts that I have undertaken in my life to do something about my life have been colossal failures. That despite what I see to be what I should be, what I am in this life continues on apace, unconcerned about my ideas about how it should unfold. So, first of all, I don't advise you or anyone else to do anything about the way your life is living itself. Like, if there's an interest in spiritual expression, then there's an interest in spiritual expression. The truth is that you're not touched by that. That doesn't hurt you. It doesn't help you. If there's a need in the life to become involved in political activism, then you will absolutely become in political activism. And the truth is that you are not touched by that. You're not affected by that. So that what I have to offer is less than that. What I have to offer is the possibility of, over time, ridding yourself of the idea that you are your life, of the belief that you are your life. Not even the idea. The idea you are your life, that comes and goes. But this root belief that this life is me can be eradicated. Now, as far as the horror story that is the way that the story of humanity is unfolding in the world today, and it is certainly a horror story. It may be, it's not so different from what we've been doing for all of our time on the planet, except that there are many more of us, and we have much greater means to inflict horrors on each other. So far as I can see in the history of humanity, nothing that has been tried to put an end to this suicidal, horrifying insanity has had any effect at all, except to shift it or move it or, turn like today, like, well, actually, 20, 30 years ago, I was deeply taken by the need to do whatever small thing I could do to destroy capitalism, because I could see so clearly that capitalism was the problem, and all the other problems flowed from that in this time. What I did in order, and I wanted peace. I wanted for human beings to live in peace with one another. I wanted for the slogan of Marxism to prevail, from each according to his needs, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. And what I did in order to serve that really, what was actually a really pure determination to bring an end to wickedness and evil in the world, was wage war. You know, wage war. Blow up buildings, rob banks, get in shootouts, escape from jail. Cause great grief and suffering and fear in people. So, I don't see that there's anything that can be done in the world to change the way human beings are with each other. I don't see anything that works. It all resolves itself down to warfare by a different name. I am at war with war. And yet, it is self-evidently and obviously incomprehensibly stupid and insane for us to be doing this to each other. I mean, it is just, there are no two human beings really separate anywhere on earth. We are in this boat together. Always have been. Always will be until we wipe ourselves out. But what I have also seen is that once this root belief that I am at stake in this life is gone, what goes with it is the whole internal movement of warfare, which begins in the human heart with the movement, I want this, I don't want that. I must have this, I must have pure, good, peaceful, enlightened thoughts, and I must not have these ugly, hateful, unenlightened thoughts. I must have good, pure, peaceful, loving desires, and not have greedy, lustful, self-serving desires. That's where the war starts. That's where the whole war starts. And in the absence of the belief that I am at stake in this life, that war is gone. And I see so obviously what Ramana meant. You know, when the ashram was robbed, I don't know if you know about this, but the ashram was robbed when Ramana was alive. You know, robbers came in and stole a bunch of stuff and ran off, and the people in the ashram, the devotees, wanted to go after them, wanted to get sticks and go after them and get their stuff back. And they said, Ramana, Ramana, we got to go get these people. And Ramana looked at him like, what's up with you anyway? Are you crazy? And he said, if you bite your tongue, are you going to punch out your teeth? Because that's exactly how stupid everything we do to try to get even with or get mind that you have, or that's exactly what it all is. It's like punching out your teeth because you bite your tongue. So, to make a very long sermon shorter, if there's anything you can do to help your fellow human beings, do it, really. If there's anything you can do to encourage people not to make war with each other, do so, really. But do continue with the inquiry that will rid you of the idea that you are at stake in whether you are engaged in spiritual ideas or engaged in political activism, that you are at stake in whether you do the right thing about this viciousness that's going on in the world now. first, always, again and again, look to see what you are. Just that. Just, you're here, right now. Just look to see what you are and do it again and again until finally this internal warfare is through. And if Sue is caught up by the desire to pursue spiritual understanding, what's that to you? Doesn't hurt you. Doesn't help you. And if Sue is caught up by the desire to do work for the good of humanity, what's that to you? You're not at stake here, really. But you have to see yourself. You have to do it again and again. And there is no possibility of you gaining an understanding of things that will free you of your negative tendencies. No possibility. The being finished with the idea, the understanding that you are your life, will do that. And there's nothing you can do to stop that, and there's nothing you can do to make that happen. Do you follow me? Okay.
So I'm going to go ahead and be greedy and ask my second question.
Yeah, really. Okay.
Last time I was here,
you
admitted that meditation is useful. And I don't know how to do it.
I was here. It's on record somewhere.
I might have said it can be useful. I did it. You know?
You flat out recommended it.
Okay. So what's your question?
How do you do it?
Here's all the meditation that I speak of is the very simplest Buddhist, or I got it from the Buddhists, right? The very simple Buddhist, I think it's called shamatha meditation. And it's just a matter of watching your breath. Okay? You sit there and you close your eyes generally. You know, it sits comfortably. You don't have to get any kind of posture or anything. Just sit down and be comfortable. And close your eyes. And focus all of your attention on the physical sensation of the air as it passes across your nostrils, the tissue of your nostrils, as the breath goes out and as it comes in. You'll see that going out it's a warm sensation, coming in it's a cooler sensation. But that's beside the point. What you're after is to get a one-pointed, attentive experience of this physical sensation. And what you do while you're doing this, with each out-breath, you say, you count. One. And the goal is to reach 10. Chances are you won't get anywhere near 10. Now, what happens is this. As you, and I'll get into why I think it's of value also.
This is on exhaling.
Huh?
Exhaling.
On the out-breath, you count. Okay? But you're focused totally on the sensation of the air crossing the flesh of the nostrils without bothering to name it or understand it or do anything with it, right? Just that raw sensation. And what will happen is this. You will count maybe two, and then you'll find yourself following some attractive thought that comes floating into the mind, right? And you may ride that train for a while, God knows how long, and then you'll remember, right? And you just say to yourself, no matter what it is, say thinking, and bring your attention back to the sensation of the breath.
Say what?
Thinking. Just think it. Thinking. And you do that even if what gets your attention is some physical pain or some, you know, itch or something, still you say thinking and bring your attention back to the breath and start over again at one. Now, the only purpose of this exercise is to strengthen the mind. There's no purpose to it whatsoever apart from that, to strengthen the mind. You know, you'll find that it makes you feel good, and that's okay too. But that's not the point. That's just a side effect. What you're after is to be able to strengthen the mind. And the reason that it's useful in the inquiry is because the whole of the inquiry is to bring your attention to bear on an experience that is not really an experience. The whole of the inquiry is to bring your attention to try to see yourself face to face. And this is not an experience that is really an experience, but you see it immediately. So the purpose of this meditation is to prepare yourself. It's like, you know, pumping iron, right? You're getting good at moving your attention, holding your attention, keeping your attention focused, one-pointedly, on an object that has no meaning. Okay? Is that helpful?
Well,
okay. Okay. But then, right, when you're doing it, when you really feel like you're doing it, look at yourself. Look at yourself. My God, I can't believe I just gave him meditation instructions. But, you know, anything works. I got nothing against anything. What I want is for everybody, every human being on the face of the planet to be finished with this ridiculous idea that they are in their lives. And anything that serves that's okay with me. Really. I'm no purist of any kind. Anybody else? Yes. Do I know your name?
No, I don't think so. My name's Amrita. Amrita.
Amrita, okay.
Could you clarify a little bit this idea of understanding that you... I couldn't quite get what you said before. You're never going to get understanding of what, but what you need is understanding of knowing that you aren't not this life. Or maybe
no,
knowing is not...
If I said that, I misspoke myself. You will never understand what you are. Never.
Why is that?
Because...
You're not that?
No. Because understanding is too small. The whole movement of understanding occurs within you. It is an arising within you. It comes and goes within you. So that as the ancient Aryans saw, what you were trying to understand is what contains you, it's impossible to do so. You can't become an object, right?
Okay.
This special skill of understanding is a small thing that comes within you. And it can't contain you because you contain it.
But yet we continue to try to understand.
No, I don't ask you to try to understand. What I ask you to do is to look at yourself face to face without understanding, without the need for understanding. You're here, right? You're never absent, are you? You know that, right?
No, I'm not sure I know that.
Well, look and see if you know that. Are you here?
I'm here.
Can I persuade you otherwise?
Probably not. No.
Probably not. But I could persuade you that I'm not here. Like if you were willing to follow a philosophical argument on the matter, I could certainly persuade you that it's not certain that I'm here. You can't be certain of that. And I could persuade you that you can't even be certain that you are here and that this body is here. I mean, you could
persuade me of that?
Sure I could. Consider it. You could be in Gitmo, strapped on a gurney with hallucinogenic drugs being pumped into you. This all could be completely manufactured. World. It could be, couldn't it? How would you know?
But what would that have to do with you believing that you're here.
Okay.
Now,
follow me. First of all, you see that, right?
Okay.
I could persuade you that this room's not here, that, you know, that nothing is not necessarily here. Not that it's not here, but that it's not necessarily here. The one thing that I can never persuade you of is that you are not here. No power on earth. If your arms and legs and everything were seen to be conditional, you are not conditional. You are absolutely here. No philosophical, metaphysical, or any other kind of argument can dissuade you of the certainty that you are here. Is that right?
Yes. Right.
Okay. So what that means is that that's all that you know.
Okay.
Now, how do you know that? What's that feel like?
To describe what it feels like.
You can't describe it.
Yeah, you can.
I'm not asking you to describe it, but you saw it for just a second. You know what I'm pointing to. That's you. That's always the same. That has been the same when you were three as it is now. That's you. And that's what I'm pointing to. And what I'm asking is that every chance you get, you look at that. Just that. And everything else that you do in life, don't worry about it. If you need to change it, try to change it. If you need to keep it from changing, try to keep it from changing. That's all beside the point. You, this reality, is neither hurt nor helped by anything that goes on there. So the inquiry is to look at that. Every chance you get, driving in the car, going to the checkout stand, fighting with somebody, whatever, whenever it occurs to you, just stop for a second and look at that certainty. And I promise you, that does the job. That takes care of it in time. Okay?
Okay.
Okay, is that helpful?
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
It's so easy. That's what's so hard to get across, is that it's really easy. Spiritual understanding is hard. You know, really, you know? And it's entertaining. Most of our spiritual activity is entertainment. Most of it. Most of what we do. We go to satsang, we go to this guy, we go to that guy. We watch tapes, we listen to spiritual music, and that's entertainment. That's okay. I mean, you know, I watch TV and I like TV. It's entertainment. But it does nothing for or against you. It cannot touch you. And I can recall a time in this life when everything that came in was needed to be looked at and weighed and held at bay for a moment, just so I could see whether this was going to be good for me or bad for me, whether it was going to enhance my understanding and enhance my power and so forth and of all of that, or diminish me. And when I started in spiritual stuff, I had that revealed itself to be the thing that I've always been looking for. That was the game I really wanted to play. And it didn't do me any good, except that it triggered in me a desperation so profound that I had to see what I was. But most of what we do is entertainment, and, you know, it's okay. It's just like those Aryans around the campfire asking, okay, what can you say about reality? You say it. And then Okay, now what can you say about reality until finally they are stunned into the surprising and huge, powerful vastness of silence, never suspecting that that vastness and that silence was them. Yes.
My name is Conrad.
Conrad?
I'm up here at the Real Scoop making a complete ass out of myself.
Okay. I do it all the time.
I'm kind of getting the idea that you're saying, basically, bottom line is that nothing really matters anyway. The bottom line is, like, it doesn't matter whether I think this or I think that, or I'm good or I'm bad. It just is. It is what it is.
Well, that may be the case, but speaking about that is of no help to you.
Understanding that's what it is, or accepting,
I don't think understanding that's
understanding
so much.
Accepting that's what it is.
No, that's not what I'm saying. And it's easy to see why it would seem that way, because that's what most spiritual teachers have to say. Accept. Just accept. Don't fight. But I've never met anybody who had any success at that. Really. I mean, if I try to accept things, what I'm really doing is fighting against my inclination to resist things. Should I not also accept my resistance if I'm going to accept everything? Should I not also accept my stupidity and my greed and my hatefulness? You know? So that what happens is that these teachings about the meaninglessness of life, about the fact that what I do or don't do has no meaning, that I'm, you know, that I don't have anything to say about it, that it's all predetermined, that it's all the unfolding of Prarabdha or whatever. These teachings which we hear and ring true, well, they ring true because, well, they kind of are true. But there's no understanding of that that will rid me of this underlying profound sense that I am at stake in this life. There's no understanding of that that will enable me to accept that in such a way that I am finished with this profound sense that I am at stake here.
At stake.
You know, like if I bet something, that's at stake. And the sense in my life is that I am at stake in this life. That what happens in this life affects me, touches me, helps me, hurts me. And the spiritual understanding that that is not the case does nothing to rid me of that profound, silent, underlying conviction. The only thing that will rid me of that, and whether or not the outcome of this is, you know, seeing that I'm unaffected by it or that I can't do anything about it or whatever, right? Whether or not that is actually the outcome of it is beside the point. The point is that all agree that the problem is a false belief about what I am. Most hold that there are things that can be done within this false belief about what I am to ameliorate or eliminate the effects of that. The truth is that nothing can be done about it except the truth. So that what I am asking and encouraging, no matter how ineffectively I do it, what I am asking and encouraging everybody to do is to forget about what you understand and what you don't understand. By which I mean, there's no need to stop trying to understand. There's no need to keep trying to understand. The only thing that will help is to see what you are, and that is beyond understanding. That's prior to understanding. But it's really easy. And it's like taking medicine. It's not like getting a spiritual.
So you think this is kind of like taking medicine anyway? I mean, yeah. I mean, it's going to make you, number one, so I guess you wouldn't be a big fan of motivational therapy.
Well, I don't have any problem with it, you know. I mean, there are things that can be done to help the mind and to move things along and so forth. I don't care about any of that. I'm not a fan nor a foe of anything that people do.
But isn't kind of like we're here and kind of a goal would be to feel good or feel, you know, I mean, I'd like to feel good.
Yeah, right.
I'd rather feel good than yes. depressed or
yes,
something
and that
like
is
that.
The goal, right, is to feel good. But the what happens in entertainment, whether it's spiritual entertainment or, right. you know, playing golf or whatever, you get to feel good for a moment or so or an hour or so, and then you go back and that feeling good goes away. But what I tell you is that you always feel good.
I like that.
You always feel good. There's never a time when you don't feel good.
But when you're fighting with your spouse.
You still feel good. I'm telling you that even when there is this conviction that you feel like crap, that itself is an aspect of feeling good. But there's no way you can know that. And that's the reason why in spiritual circles they encourage us to meet what arises and to accept what's here and all of that, you know, is to because they see that that's the case, that you always feel good. Anything that arises, if you really sink into it without resistance and with full open-heartedness, will reveal itself to be just sweet, nothing, really, anything.
You hear me getting mugged in an alley?
Yeah, but chances are you won't. Your skill at sinking into what's accepting what's here is not developed enough for to see that. But what I am telling you is that always the case is that this life, just as it is the perfect realization of reality. It is, and it is that reality calls forth this life and all life as a way of seeing itself. It's not quite that simple, but like that. And that the only thing that continues that makes it so that it's only in moments of successful entertainment that you feel good is because you have a false belief that you are this life. And that is, and the good news about that is that it's really easy to rid yourself of that false belief just by looking at what you really are. Again and again. And nobody is here saying, okay, you have to drink the Kool-Aid or, you know, like give up your firstborn son or give me all your money. Or all you have to do is just look at yourself. You never have to see me again in life. All you have to do is whenever it occurs to you to do so, stop for a second and say, what is it to be here? What is that? What am I, really? And you'll see, and then you'll go look at other things, but the effect of that continued meeting with reality is over time to destroy this false belief. And before you know it's gone, you will see that life is easy.
I'll work on it.
Let me know. And in the meantime, you know, entertain yourself. What do I care? Jan?
Hi, John.
Hi, Jan. I'm happy to see you.
I'm happy to see you, too. I'm here more and more and more. And, it's very... it's weird.
Mm-hmm.
It almost... There's almost no central point.
Yes, that's right.
Um, and my heart's pounding. Well, the sensation. But the central point is kind of disappears.
Yes, yes, it does, very much so.
There's nothing to do, I guess. Is there? Other than...
There's nothing that needs to be done. Really, there is not. You know, you might see that it might happen to you, and I don't want to... Well, I've said it now, so I'm going to continue. It is my experience as time progresses in the absence of this craziness.
Mm-hmm.
It's my experience that that we are in this together, all of humanity in this together, so that the persistence of insanity anywhere within this human mind, because it's not your mind and my mind, that just really, that's why that central point is beginning to lose its force. It's just mind. Mm-hmm. And the persistence anywhere in this human mind of this idea that I am bound, that I am at stake here, if it's present anywhere, it's present in me. How could it be otherwise? I can't find anything anywhere but me. Can you? So, and that's all. Just the point of seeing the possibility of that is not to be taken by surprise by it. Mm. Right? The craziness of mind persists. That's just the way it is. And the craziness of mind is the craziness of the entire human mind. We're in this together. We're in the same boat. And the only thing that we can do is see what's real. That's all. And that's all.
Sometimes it feels dangerous.
It's quite dangerous. I mean, you know, in a overt and in the sense of the way the mind is quite dangerous. It's thrilling, you know. But the dangerous and thrilling doesn't touch you, really. It doesn't, and the sense of the danger and the thrill is precisely because there is not two human beings anywhere. There are not two human minds anywhere to be found. The only mind that is present here is the human mind. And it's crazy, and it's dangerous, and it's thrilling. And the point of that is just not to be taken by surprise by it. To see in the face of the thrill and the danger that you are untouched by it. All you can do for humanity is to see what you are, is to constantly and consistently move your attention back to reality, back to reality. That's what you can do for humanity. Because just as the totality of the human mind is present here as you, the totality of the human mind includes this free mind, this freedom, this lack of the need to do something, to change something, to fix something, to kill something off, to make something better. Even to make better or to kill or to change or to do away with the impulse that comes in this life to do something, to change something, to make something better. Always to see, always to move attention back to what you are and see if it is not true that you are untouched by it. You're not looking for what you are in order to confirm some spiritual idea, but to see whether it's true. Are you touched by it? Are you helped by it? Are you hurt by it? Are you not the same as you have always been? This reality, this ineffable reality? And the point of that is to see what's true. Just that. Just to see what's true. And to face yourself.
And at the same time, there's joy.
There's what?
Joy.
Joy, of course, is joy. That's all there is. Yes, this is, you know, and in the old days when they were describing these things, like yesterday and the day before, they called this causeless joy.
What joy?
Causeless.
Oh, causeless.
Causeless joy. You know, and when, as this need to understand things goes along with the idea that you're at stake in this life, then you see these things that have been said from this side, and you see what they were trying to say, what they're talking about, and see how far short, like such a term as causeless joy, falls from saying anything real about what you're talking about. But you see what they meant. That's what they meant.
It's just there.
Not what I thought. Right?
Yeah. It's just there.
I mean, just there. Just there. That's it. Just, it's you. It's you. It's you. You know? You are, really. You are. These lives, this energy of life, is realization. That's what realization is. You and you and you and you together, all as these forms arise and change and shift and move and play and dance. That's realization. That's the realization of reality. That's you. And you are the source of it all. You are this ineffable, simple, unable to say anything about certainty of being. Mm-hmm. And from you springs the joy and the beingness and the, all of it.
I know.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It's amazing.
It is amazing. I mean,
it's amazing. It's amazing. You know, I remember when we first met over there on the
yeah.
Wherever that was, yeah. I remember you coming up and going, look at you now.
Yeah.
You wanted to fight. You're so beautiful.
It's amazing.
It is. Who would have thunk it?
Mm. Yeah. Not me.
Not me.
Thank you. Thanks, John.
You're very welcome. Okay, I think we're just about out of time. I probably one more if anybody wants to say something, but don't have to. Okay, I guess I've said about all I can say for one night. Is that never, you know, when we were in Chicago, we just came back from a trip to Chicago and Boulder, which was really quite magnificent. And we had a one day, a full day with the folks in Chicago. And the first meeting of the full day, I I must have thought I was Castro or something. I spoke for an hour and, God, I don't know, forever. It never ceases to amaze me how much I manage to say about something about which nothing can be said. And I excuse myself with the excuse that, and really, it's the truth. With the excuse, it can be the truth even as the excuse. With the excuse that I do so always in order only to get us all kind of tricked into looking at what's real. Not tricked into drinking the Kool-Aid or going into samadhi or any of that stuff. But kind of getting us all tricked into, for just a second, seeing what's real. So that we know and can recognize what it is that we are when we look again. So, in the end, it comes down to this. There's nothing but you, anywhere to be found. And the only activity that can rid you of the underlying dissatisfaction and the need to seek is to find out what you are. You are not your lives. You are not. You're here. So thank you for your time. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for everything. I'm your servant. May all being know itself.